Anything worth saying is worth talking about. Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, friends. This is Michael Parker on Deprogram, and today is May the 25th here in the United States. And I'm going to be honest, I'm not my usual buoyant self today. I didn't sleep great last night. As you heard in that previous news report, yesterday in Uvalde, Texas, my home state, 21 people were killed by a young man, a lone gunman who went into an elementary school in a small town of Uvalde. Uvalde is, I think, about 60 to 80 miles from San Antonio. It is largely a Hispanic community. It's kind of best known as being the hometown of Matthew McConaughey. And apparently this young man, I guess he broke into the school. Somehow he got into the school. He barricaded himself in a room of fourth graders and then, you know, shot indiscriminately and killed adults and children. Apparently, a Border Patrol tactical unit had responded to the scene at the behest of local law enforcement, and they broke some windows. They were trying to help people get out of the school. They killed the shooter. And, you know, I've been doing this job for quite a while, not on this particular network, but I've been doing radio and commentary since around 2006. And I've seen this, you know, many, many times now. And whenever one of these mass shootings happens, there's always this rush to, you know, address it in the media, politicians, celebrities, et cetera, and, you know, tomorrow we're going to talk about this at length for 2 hours. I've got Los Angeles Sheriff's candidate Matthew Rodriguez coming on. We're going to discuss it probably for 2 hours. And so there's a lot of issues around these school shootings. And what always bothers me beyond the tragedy and the loss of life, which is the thing that we should most be talking about, not politics, is just the rush to talk about politics. And to be clear, you know, I do not have the answer on what to do about these types of situations, but I also don't think that politicians do, or NBA basketball coaches, or late night comedians. And I say that just because as I'm preparing for the show and I've got my wife has the news on, that's all you're seeing is all these people, you know, being very righteous about all of this. And I don't know, it's just a tragedy all around. This takes the wind out of my sails in a big way. I didn't sleep well. So to the people, the families of Uvalde, Texas, all of us are thinking about you. All of us are upset and we're all praying for you. And I think we need more conversation as opposed to accusation when it comes to whatever we're going to do in regards to gun control. Like I say, I don't have the answer. I know that we need to do something. I just don't know what that is. And I just wish that every time this happened, we didn't get this sudden rush of finger pointing and yelling and screaming. We just need more conversation. So I'm going to leave you with these thoughts that were shared by Matthew McConaughey, who grew up there, because I think that his words were better than most of the words that I heard coming from politicians or celebrities or anybody. So I'm going to read this right quick. As you're all aware, there was another mass shooting today, this time in my hometown of Uvalde, Texas. Once again, we have tragically proven that we are failing to be responsible for the rights our freedoms grant us. The true call to action now is for every American to take a longer and deeper look in the mirror and ask ourselves, what is it that we truly value? How do we repair the problem? What small sacrifices can we individually take today to preserve a healthier and safer nation, state, and neighborhood tomorrow? We cannot exhale once again and make excuses and accept these tragic realities as the status quo. As Americans, Texans, mothers, and fathers, it's time we reevaluate and negotiate our wants from our needs. We have to rearrange our values and find a common ground above this devastating American reality that has tragically become our children's issue. This is an epidemic we can control, and whichever side of the aisle we may stand on, we all know we can do better. We must do better. Action must be taken so that no parent has to experience what the parents in Uvalde and the others before them have endured. And to those who dropped off their loved ones today, not knowing it was goodbye, no words can comprehend or heal your loss. But if prayers can provide comfort, we will keep them coming. So those are the words of Matthew McConaughey, who is from Uvalde, Texas. This is TNT Radio.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversations.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, you're listening to Deprogram. I am your host, Michael Parker, and in this hour, we are going to continue to explore a subject that we talk a lot about, not only on this show, but on TNT in general, which is the subject of climate science, climate change. And today's guest is Ron Barmby. He is the author of Sunlight on Climate Change, A Heretic's Guide to Global Climate Hysteria. He's also a regular writer at climatechangedispatch.com, and his website is ronaldbarmby.ca. And Ronald, good morning. Welcome to the show. Ron.
Good morning, Michael.
Thank you for joining me today. And, you know, I was looking over your work last night, and, you know, in the last several weeks, I've spoken to a lot of people who've opened my eyes to the climate question. And I, like most people, view this through a lens of the fact that we've been told year after year after year through our various institutions that this thing is happening. It's very bad. And we are on a trail to self-destruction. Yet, I don't know that we have all the facts here, and someone comes along like yourself and some of these other gentlemen who've been on my show who put all these things in a new light. So I guess the very first question that we have to answer, which is the most simple one or the most fundamental one before we get deep, is, are we in a climate crisis?
No, we're not in a climate crisis. Climate change has occurred naturally for thousands of years. And we've lived through more severe rates of climate change than we are experiencing right now. I'm not saying that the climate change we're experiencing right now is not influenced by humans whatsoever. I'm saying that there is a very strong natural component to it. The reason I take that view, Michael, is if you go back to the end of the last ice age, at the last glacial period, we had an event that demonstrates how quickly the climate can change.
The Younger Dryas?
The Younger Dryas. So we were in the ice age, and then in a period of a couple centuries, it warmed up 10 or 12 degrees. And then it dropped down again back into ice age conditions. Now that dropping down again is the Younger Dryas cooling period. And then in about 50 to 100 years, and of course, it's very hard to pinpoint these types of fine timing sequences that far back, but something in the order of 50 to 100 years, it popped back up to 10 degrees warmer. So we had a rapid warming, a rapid cooling, and then a rapid warming again. And so about 10,000 years ago, when the last ice age finally ended, it climbed up to a couple degrees warmer than it is today. And during those last 10,000 years, you can argue, how fine you can read the graph, but between 90 and 95% of the time, it has been warmer than it is today. And there's been large fluctuations. Now, we get those large fluctuations from multiple sciences, anthropology, geology, the people that go digging in caves and look at stalactites and stalagmites. We get a lot of great information from ice cores, where they look at isotopes of oxygen, and they can figure out by the isotopes of oxygens the temperature of the snow when it fell on in Greenland or in Antarctica. So it's climate change has been happening quite a bit. Probably the Holocene maximum period people are aware of, 6,500 years ago, it was probably in Europe 3 degrees warmer than it is today. The argument against that from climate change promoters is that, well, you've got a temperature in one spot in the world. It's not reflective of the global average, but it's still a temperature spot. And typically, you can't extrapolate with other sciences to connect them.
Ron, say that period again, and this was 6,500 years ago. What was this?
That was the Holocene maximum.
Got it. Okay.
Holocene maximum. And then it
go ahead.
Oh, then it cooled down again, and then we went into the medieval, the Roman warming period, and it was a couple degrees warmer than today. But the real thing that we can hang our hat on, because we have more records from what we would call contemporary humans, and what I mean is people not living in caves, but people growing crops, and you can see how their culture changes. But from 1300 to 1850, we went through the Little Ice Age. Mm-hmm. And the temperature went up and down by a few degrees in periods of less than a century. And we have these records by how people lived. We have these records after about 1750 before that, the first primitive thermometers were about 1650, the first ones that had closed glass ends. They didn't use mercury, they used alcohol, but they could still take temperatures. And so when you ask yourself, why were the Romans wearing togas when they were building Hadrian's Wall in Scotland? Well, it was warm. It was warmer then. Why were they growing olives in Germany? Why were they growing grapes in England? When the Vikings came to Canada in a place that now is rather inhospitable, which is Newfoundland, inhospitable because of the weather, they mm-hmm. called it Vinland because of the grapes that were growing wild there. So we know from all these things that we've had warmer temperatures than we've had today. I was talking about the first thermometers. We know from monks that kept records of vineyard temperatures in Europe. Of course, they were tracking records of when their grapes were ripe, and they correlated that to the temperature in the growing seasons. And so with these crude thermometers, we saw swings in 30 years of up to 3 degrees Celsius. By the way, Mike, all the temperatures I quote are Celsius. That's what
we're understood. Well, we have a large audience. We have a large audience. Actually, yeah. Our station is based out of Australia, and we have a large European audience, so that'll be great.
Yeah. So we have all these records of people, their cultures and their crops and their clothing being influenced by temperature changes. And we just seem to have ignored that. What has happened is that we've accepted that we've accepted the viewpoint that the Little Ice Age was really an isolated event, that there wasn't mm-hmm. much happening. And then all of a sudden, pop, it got a degree warmer. Well, you have to put that into context that at first it got about a degree or 2 degrees cooler. And that happened and went up and down between 1300 and 1850. And 1850 was the end of the Little Ice Age. And so it started warming up. And this was before humans started putting lots of carbon dioxide in the air. And I'm not saying that humans didn't put a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. We definitely have. But is that what drove climate change? Now, theoretically, it will have an influence, but my contention looking at the science is that influence is very small. I think the influence of climate change in the last century was largely driven by sun activity.
And I think the people that know a little bit about this, if they are not fully buying into the climate crisis hysteria, they will know or have heard or generally have an idea that it is related to sunspot or sun activity, which makes sense. I mean, it's the giant nuclear reactor in the sky, right? That which we derive all energy from. So if you could go, let's see. Yeah, we got plenty of time, right? We got like 5 or 7 minutes till the break. So I want you to you have the floor to also talk about the sun, the energy that comes to the earth that gets reflected back. You have the floor.
Okay, well, thanks, Mike. So what I'm going to try to do is explain why the Earth is not a greenhouse. And mm-hmm. The purpose of that is that we have allowed a simplification of the science because of the name of the greenhouse gas effect, that the Earth is a greenhouse. And a greenhouse, of course, has a solid glass roof, and it traps energy inside. And if you build a scenario that CO2 in the air is like a solid glass roof on the Earth, you're going to get the belief in your head that the more CO2 we add, the more heat we're going to trap. And the only commonality between a greenhouse and the greenhouse gas effect is the word greenhouse, and there's nothing else in common. So what happens is that as energy, as radiation energy leaves the sun, it is a shorter wavelength energy, and it gets beamed at the Earth, and before it gets to the surface of the Earth, some things happen. Some of it gets bounced off of clouds, some of it gets bounced off of the atmosphere. Some of it makes it almost all the way to the surface of the Earth, and it'll bounce off of ice and reflect back. But roughly about half on any given day of the short wavelength radiation that the sun emits that enters our atmosphere actually warms up the ground. And then it warms up the ground, and the energy is released, but it's a longer wave radiation. So it's gone from short wave to longer wave. And
can I ask why that, how does that happen? It goes from short wave to long wave.
It's just the absorption effect. So
and that changes the wavelength.
Changes. Yeah. So it's absorbed by the water, it's absorbed by the rocks, and then it's released again. Okay. And it goes into long wave. Now, some of that long wave or some of the energy that is released is in the form of evaporation of water. And so it takes a great deal of energy to heat up water and make it evaporate. And when it evaporates, it goes up into convection currents. And you can see those every day in a thunderhead cloud. Now, if you put a greenhouse roof over one of those convection currents, it's going to trap all of that water vapor that's trying to escape and all the heat contained into it. 70% of the heat that is released by the surface of the Earth is in convection currents and water vapor evaporation. A greenhouse can trap that, and it gets warm very quickly. About 30% of the long wave radiation that escapes the surface of the Earth maintains the long wave form. It's not heating up water. It's coming off like heat off of a toaster. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's starting to go up into the air. And here's where the greenhouse gas effect comes in. So the greenhouse gas effect, each particular gas can absorb a particular long wavelength radiation. And so what a lot of people don't know is 90% of the greenhouse gas effect is caused by water in the air. So water in the air will absorb this long wave radiation. And of course, there's nothing that human beings can do to control the amount of water in the air. It's evaporated from the oceans. And so that leaves a smaller portion that can be influenced by humans. And the gases, the main gas that the IPCC talks about and that our politicians talk about is carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And the argument is that we've added so much carbon dioxide to the atmosphere that it's upset the equilibrium. So here's how the greenhouse gas effect works with carbon dioxide. Some of the radiation that's given off the surface of the Earth is between 14.5 microns and 16 microns. Now, a human hair is about 100 microns in diameter. So this is like a fine human hair, probably more like mine than like yours, Michael. Oh. And so when it comes up and hits carbon dioxide, I use the example in my book, is like a fish weir. Mm-hmm. And so how fish weirs work is you have a row of sticks in a river that are placed a certain distance apart. And then upstream, you have more rows of sticks that are a little bit closer together. And the way it works is that fish that are too big to get into the downstream sticks, they're too fat, they have to go around. So mm-hmm. they're not caught in the weir. Fish that are smaller than those two sticks can get in, but when they get to the second set of sticks, if they're too fat, they can't get out. And so Indigenous people in Canada use that technique to trap salmon. Mm-hmm. And so the salmon are swimming upriver. They can get through the first sticks, but they can't get past the second. Now, if the fish are smaller than salmon, they can go through both sets of sticks. And so what happens is that fish of a certain size, which happens to be salmon, get trapped in the weir.
Yes.
Carbon dioxide is like that. It can only trap heat waves between 14 and a half and 16 microns. And so it doesn't matter how much CO2 is in the air. What matters is how much radiation between those two wavelengths is coming from the ground. And so it's like the first fisherman on a river, his catch is really good because he's the furthest downstream and the most fish are there. And so let's say he catches 10 fish and his buddies see this and they say, well, this is a good place to fish. We're each going to build our own weir. But they catch 10 fish in total, 5 each. And they say, well, how come he's got more fish than us? He built one weir, he got 2 fish or 10 fish. We built 2 weirs, we only got 5. And then more fishermen come along and they build 4 more weirs. So now there's 7 weirs. But those new 4 weirs only catch as much fish as the first weir.
Right.
And so there's no shortage of weirs, Michael. What there's a shortage of is fish. And so
I understand. Ron, we got to take a quick break. This will just be like 2 minutes. I'm speaking with Ron Barmby. We're talking about climate and is climate change really a thing or has it always been here? This is TNT Radio. My program is Deprogram. We'll be right back.
God, you're amazing. You're a much better listener than my wife. You're always there for me. I think I may be in love.
Where is she?
Well, it's not what it seems. I was talking to...
Who's the tramp I heard you talking to?
That was my Alexa, sweetie.
Well, she sounds like a tramp.
Fall in love with news and talk all over again with your smart device. Just tell it to play.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The 2020 election was the most secure in U.S. history. There has been no evidence of widespread voter fraud.
He lost a fair and secure election.
The most secure election in American history.
Really?
All those of you who volunteered and worked the polls, you deserve a special thanks from the entire nation.
This one mule made 53 trips to 20 drop boxes. He's not alone. We tracked 2,000 mules making multiple ballot drops. Leaving no fingerprints. Snapping photos to get paid. A coordinated ring of illegal vote harvesting in all the key states where the election was decided.
They've delivered us a clear victory.
Game over.
Stream May 8th at Salem Now or Locals.
A bushfire tip from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service.
It's a fact that cars are a significant cause of bushfire. Parking in long dry grass means hot exhaust and hot brakes may start a fire. When travelling in bushland areas, remember to park in designated car parks or away from dry vegetation. And whatever you do, don't throw cigarette butts out the car window. Prevention of bushfires is your responsibility. Get FireWise. For more information, contact your local fire station.
Government couldn't stop a flu-like virus.
And now they want you to believe they can stop the Earth's climate from changing?
The voice of reason is TNT Radio.
Hello, friends. This is Deprogram. I'm your host, Michael Parker, and we are speaking with Ron Barmby. When we left, he was giving an illustration using a device called a fishweir, and we were talking about CO2 being able to absorb long-wave infrared radiation. Ron, I want to make I'm going to let you continue on, and then I'm going to have a couple of questions because I just want to make sure I understand all this correctly. But go ahead with your illustration.
Okay. So we talked about more and more fish weirs are added, but each time those additional fish weirs, you double the amount of fish weirs, but you catch the same amount of fish. So one fish weir, say, catches 10 fish, the next two catch five, the next five each for a total of 10, and the next four catch a total of 10. So what's happening is you're having to double your effort each time to catch the same amount of fish. And that's what's known in mathematics as a logarithmic progression. Mm-hmm. Now, the founding principle of the greenhouse gas effect was written by a man named Savante Arrhenius in 1896. And it is the physical equation that the IPCC uses, that NASA uses, that everyone who tries to calculate how much global warming is going to happen uses. And so it's been established for well over 100 years that climate change caused by carbon dioxide is a logarithmic effect. And what it means is that you have to double the amount of carbon dioxide each time to get the same temperature increase. So if you go back to 1850, the end of the last ice age, and you go to today and you say there's been about a 1 degree increase in temperature. I'm just using a round number. Mm-hmm. And let's also say that back in Arrhenius's time in 1896, there was about 280 parts per million carbon dioxide in the air. And now we have about 410 parts per million carbon dioxide in the air. And so we can work out mathematically that that first doubling of temperature, because we've already experienced 1 degree, by the time we get to the doubling of 560 parts per million, we will only have increased the temperature by 1.5 degrees C. Now, Michael, that assumes there's no other factors. The sun is not a factor. The coming out of the little ice age isn't a factor. That is all on us. It's all on us. So that 1.5 degrees is spread over almost 200 years because we're not going to hit 560 until close to 2080 or so. So that is not, in my mind, a climate emergency, 1.5 degrees in 200 years, because we experienced that before. And we experienced it in during the Little Ice Age, and we certainly experienced it at the end of the Younger Dryas period. But if you look ahead to that, what the Arrhenius equation says, now you have to double the concentration of CO2 again to get the same 1.5 degrees. So instead of adding 280 parts per million, you have to add 560. So now we're 300 or 400 years into the future if we haven't changed our lifestyle to get another 1.5 degrees. So we're centuries down the road. And that's only if it's all caused by carbon dioxide. One thing that we know, that during the Little Ice Age, we had five consecutive grand solar minimums. And these grand solar minimums was when the sun was at a very low activity. And then as we came out of the Little Ice Age, we went into the modern solar maximum. And the modern solar maximum peaked between 1950 and about 1980. Now we are entering into the lowest sunspot activity in the last 200 years. And if you haven't noticed, global warming, the rate of global warming doesn't seem to be all that severe. So we cannot say that a correlation between two events is one causes the other, but it shouldn't be ignored that as the sun activity diminishes, the Earth gets cooler, and as the sun activity increases, the Earth gets warmer. Now, the IPCC addresses this, Michael, but they don't address it completely. What we've learned recently at the CERN collider in Europe is that the sun activity influences the amount of cloud cover on Earth. What the IPCC and a lot of scientists will say is, yes, the sun gets a little bit hotter, a little bit cooler, but it's so minor that it doesn't affect the Earth, the output of energy. But what does affect the Earth is the magnetic field of the sun. So our little planet is getting bombarded constantly by galactic cosmic rays that come into our atmosphere. And when those cosmic rays hit aerosols in the atmosphere, small little charged particles, they charge them further and they make them polar molecules. And those polar molecules start joining together and form clouds. Mm-hmm. And if you increase the cloud cover on Earth, that radiation from the sun gets blocked. Now, a low dense cloud, and anyone who's gone camping will know this, is that during the daytime, if you have a low dense cloud, the sun gets reflected away and you're colder. And a low dense cloud at night traps the heat escaping from night, and you're going to have a warmer night in your tent. So it depends on whether the sun is incoming or the radiation is outgoing. So we know that the changing magnetic field, which is directly related to the number of sunspots, sunspot is kind of like a speedometer on the sun. How active is the sun? We know that a 1% change in cloud cover on Earth could account for all of the global warming that we saw in the 20th century.
1%.
Yeah. And so when the sun is very active and the sunspots are high, like they were in the 20th century, that magnetic field of the sun is stronger and it deflects those galactic cosmic rays away from the planet Earth. So less cosmic rays hitting our atmosphere means there is less cloud cover. Less cloud cover means more of the sun's energy hits the Earth and we could warm up.
Yes.
Conversely, we go into a period of low sun activity like we had during the little ice ages. There is the magnetic field of the sun is weaker. More cosmic rays make through the sun's magnetic field. They hit the atmosphere of the Earth and they cause increased cloud cover. So that effect is something the IPCC doesn't even look at. And so to blame it all on carbon dioxide without looking at what is the source of our energy, the sun doing, and what is the cloud cover doing is a big omission. And go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, okay, so I'm understanding what you're saying, perhaps only on an elementary level, but as a layperson, I'm understanding what you're saying. So I guess the question becomes, there have to be other earth scientists and just regular scientists who understand what you're saying. So why the predominance of thought regarding CO2 being the primary reason for this so-called climate crisis that we are supposedly in?
Well, if you look at the founding document from the United Nations for the creation of the IPCC, it's very biased into blaming carbon dioxide for global warming. They're supposed to be looking at the state of the art of climate. And if you read the resolution kind of says, we want you to find that carbon dioxide is the reason for warming. So let me do a little recap, Michael.
Please.
What's happened in my mind is that the temperature record for the last 1,000 years has been altered to get away with to eliminate natural climate change, and to create a scenario that we've had a constant temperature on Earth for the last couple thousand years, and it's only changed now. That is not true.
Right.
The second thing that I think is wrong is that our education system, our media, our politicians have latched on to an oversimplified description of climate change, and they've called it a greenhouse. In fact, John Kerry went around the world saying that carbon dioxide is like a thin glass barrier at the top. A greenhouse traps convection and evaporation energy under a solid roof. The greenhouse gas effect traps only radiation area and only some of it. And when it traps that radiation, it gives, and when it releases it, it goes in all direction, including outer space. And so it's that recycling back to the ground that keeps us warm. Mm-hmm. So the radiation goes up to the carbon dioxide. And as I said, it's mostly water that does this. The water absorbs a specific length of long wave radiation, and then it releases it in all directions. And that's why you have to keep doubling the amount of that radiation, because it all doesn't get directed back towards Earth. It gets spread out into space also. So that's the second problem, is that we've allowed ourselves as a society to be convinced that we live in a greenhouse, and we do not. We live in the greenhouse gas effect. The third thing that I think is wrong is that the IPCC and the governments and our politicians are silent on that you have to keep doubling every time the amount of CO2 to get the same temperature increase.
Right.
And I could say the fourth thing that is wrong is that they have told us that the entire temperature increase, about 1°C since the end of the Little Ice Age, is due to human adding carbon dioxide. And I think that's wrong too, because we had a grand solar maximum during the 20th century. So all those four things together, I think, are what the mistake. And I'll get back to your question here. Why haven't you heard about it? Well, you're probably aware. I listened to your discussion on the horrific news in Texas yesterday. There was another news item in yesterday about a banker in HBSC in mm-hmm. London, who spoke out not on the science of climate change, but how trivial the impact of climate change is mm-hmm. On an economics, and how the ESG scenario is hobbling the banks to worry about a problem that he said isn't really that severe. And now he's suspended. And yep. So what happened, I can write about this because I'm an old boomer who's retired. And Nigel Lawson can write about it because he's even older than me and he's very wealthy and retired. But if you're a working person and you come against climate change, you can't speak out because your company or your employer would take exception to it. I've had people who read my books and said, Ron, I'd like to write a nice review, but my employer wouldn't like it. And it's just that it is so unpopular to yes. come across as a denier. And that's one thing I do say in my book, Michael, is I am not a denier. I'm a heretic. A denier won't accept an idea, even though it's proven to be true.
Yes.
And a heretic won't accept an idea because there's no proof that it's true. And I think the human contribution to climate change is extremely small. And no matter what size it is, it's mostly over because of the Arrhenius equation saying that you have to keep doubling the amount of CO2.
Ron, when I posed that question, I knew the answer, but I wanted to hear you say it. And I agree with you completely. And what I tell people if the climate question comes up and they're like, Michael Parker, you surely aren't one of those climate deniers. And what I try to say is like, well, let's just start with this idea. Let's separate pollution from climate change, because I believe that we should be good stewards of our planet. And so let's separate those two subjects. And climate change has always existed. And if we clean up our act, which we should do, this is going to sound like hyperbole, but I tell them just to get a rise out of them. How are you going to get a volcano to limit its carbon emissions? I say that in jest, but it's like, I mean, these things have to be taken into consideration, and most people have never even thought of these things. So I agree with you. The climate is constantly changing because it's a dynamic system. We've got to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Ron Barmby, and we're going to come back with our final segment. This is TNT Radio. My name is Michael Parker. This is Deprogram. We'll be right back.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The big legacy media has sought to control the public mind in the primaries for the November midterm elections, but it's now clear from some hysterical whining that the legacy media is fast losing control of the narrative. Analysis by CNN's Ronald Brownstein on the 24th of May is a case in point. The headline of his article is "Election Deniers Want to Control the 2024 Election, and They're Getting Closer." Brownstein runs with the typical legacy media line that former President Donald Trump pushes a discredited lie about rampant fraud in the 2020 presidential election. But he seems shocked that so many GOP candidates expressing this view have been nominated or are seeking nominations for positions with control over election machinery in all five of the states that flipped from supporting Trump in 2016 to Biden in 2020. Expect some more hysterical whining. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
In this day and age, everybody deserves the right to access phone and internet services. Whether you're from regional, rural or remote Australia, the Regional Tech Hub can independently assist with providing advice on connectivity options in your local area, or work with you and your service provider to resolve outstanding issues with phone and internet. And our service is absolutely free. Find out more by visiting regionaltechhub.org.au or by calling 1300 081 029. RTH is an initiative of the Australian Government, delivered by the NFF.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
In a news release from the 30th of March 2021, the World Health Organization announced that 25 heads of government and international agencies had issued a joint call for high-level political action to protect the world from future health crises. Ominously, world leaders said the international community should work together towards a new international treaty for pandemic preparedness and response, to build a more robust global health architecture that will protect future generations. There will be other pandemics and other major health emergencies. No single government or multilateral agency can address this threat alone, the leaders declared. The question is not if, but when. Together, we must be better prepared to predict, prevent, detect, assess, and effectively respond to pandemics in a highly coordinated fashion. The COVID-19 pandemic has been a stark and painful reminder that nobody is safe until everyone is safe. The Prime Ministers of Italy, United Kingdom, President of France, Chancellor of Germany, President of Ukraine were among the signatories.
What? Are you kidding me?
If you can't believe what you're hearing, then get the straight talk from us. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Friends, you are listening to Deprogram. I'm your host, Michael Parker. I'm speaking with Ron Barmby. He is the author of Sunlight at Climate Change, A Heretic's Guide to Global Climate Hysteria. He has been explaining to us that we actually aren't in a climate crisis, and explaining why, and talking about the greenhouse effect that's not really a greenhouse effect. Ron, I wanted to change gears just for a second, because I noticed one other thing you addressed in your book is you were talking about the inelastic curve of like gasoline prices. So right now here in California, I don't know how it is where you're at in Canada. I'm assuming it's very expensive. Here in California, it's off the charts. And two days ago, they said the highest price around town was around $7.27, which is unbelievable to me. The average price here in LA is about $6.20, $6.50, something like that. Anyway, talk about gasoline and this inelastic supply curve, because people have to have gasoline. It's not something they can just stop using, like stop eating cupcakes to go on a diet.
That's correct, Michael. It's something that we need that we don't have a backstop for. And that's the fundamental part of inelasticity. So gasoline is an inelastic product because within a reasonable range, we will pay whatever that cost is because we need it. There's no backup. And if there was a backup, we would switch to it. But we don't have battery electric vehicles everywhere. We don't have mass transit everywhere. A lot of people live in rural communities. The internal combustion engine is at this point the dominant source of transportation, and there's no feasible economic alternative to it. And we don't even have to look at today's high prices, Michael, to demonstrate how inelastic that demand is. Because if you look at the last decades of oil prices, you go back, you know, to when I'll give an example of how old I am. When I entered university, oil was $2 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated 4 years later, it was $20 a barrel. And now it's $120 a barrel.
Yes.
Well, the use of gasoline has just steadily increased year after year, despite what the price is. And people aren't driving less. Arguably, they're driving more. 2 years ago in Canada, because of problems we had with pipelines and everything else, the price of crude oil actually went negative. We were at like negative $5 a barrel. And people mm-hmm. didn't run out, and they didn't cross the country because gasoline was almost free, and they didn't, you know, they drove the same amount. And now it's $110 a barrel, and people still have to drive to get to work. So that inelasticity of gasoline is like inelasticity of food. You need food. You just can't give it up.
Ron, the reason I bring this up is because the climate crisis scare and all this move to go to other sources of energy, what it ends up doing on a practical level, and in full disclosure, Ron, I grew up in the petroleum business. My dad was a small-time producer, worked his butt off day in and day out. And, you know, oil just a few years ago was at a price that it was not worth the risk of drilling for it, because, you know, you're going to come up with dry holes a lot more often than you're going to find oil. People think that, you know, this is just something that that oil producers do. They go out, drill oil, they find it, dot, dot, dot. No, you can lose a lot of money real quick is what happens. But just a couple of years ago, my dad and his friends in Texas, you know, they had stopped doing this because it wasn't worth the risk. Well, guess what? Now it is worth the risk again. And it's because prices have soared. It's because of bad policy. And that policy at its root is linked back to our original discussion, which is this climate crisis that we are supposedly experiencing. And I just bring that up because it's like so many problems that we have now that I don't know if they're really problems or if we're making problems where problems didn't exist. And then it ends up having these consequences. In this case, we've got massive energy prices that, you know, a guy like me, I can afford it. I can suck this up. But my gardener who works for me and comes once a week, you know, I mean, this is killing him. And a year or so ago, no, actually it was in the last year, Governor Newsom here in my state said that gardeners are going to have to quit using gasoline-based blowers and hedger, just all of the units at the lawnmowers. Okay, and that seems like not a big deal, but those products don't work as well. They still have to come from some form of electricity or some form of energy, which is electricity. Anyway, I'm just saying this because this is all ironic, and it gets back to this lie that is being perpetuated that we're in a climate crisis.
Well, Michael, let me pick or paint a much darker picture than your gardener.
Go for it.
And the war in Ukraine, I believe, wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the climate scare, the climate hysteria.
Wow. Yep.
So Europe is driven into, we have to decarbonize, we have to get rid of, you know, the North Sea was a big producer of oil and gas. Mm-hmm. They stopped exploring there. Germany, big producer of coal. We have to shut that down. For some reason, they said nuclear is no good. Nuclear, of course, is emissions free. So they started shutting it down. Everything is going to solar and into wind power because those are green, renewable energies. The energy crisis in Europe started with a 10% drop in wind speed, only 10%. So now these windmills aren't producing enough electricity and they got to burn natural gas. So they're burning natural gas and they deplete the reservoirs during the summertime because the wind isn't blowing as strong. Winter comes along, they need more natural gas, and the only place they can get it is from Russia. So they're paying high prices to Russia to backstop their failed green energy technology, and they get 40% of their oil from Russia. So they're filling up Putin's coffers, enabling him to rearm and everything else. And then he's in a position that they're not going to stand up to me, because if they do, I can shut them down and cut off their energy, and they have no alternative. So Europe backed itself into a corner. They became over-reliant on an untested green technology scenario, and it failed. In the meantime, they shut down all their backstop technology, which was coal and nuclear. Now, the Germans are starting up their coal plants again, and they're deferring their shutdown of nuclear plants, because now they know they're funding the war in Ukraine, and they know that their lack of energy security gave Putin confidence to invade Ukraine. So here the United Nations, which was set up to prevent war, has actually promoted the scenario where war was enabled. And I think that's the worst case scenario.
You are absolutely correct. That was very well said. And I mean, I was talking about this yesterday that, you know, India has already said, hey, listen, we're not going to stop buying Russian oil. You can forget about that. Saudi Arabia and OPEC have said to Europe, listen, we're not going to cover that 1 million barrels a day. If you stop buying it from Russia, we're not going to cover that for you. So we go back to the core of this. And again, it's about energy. It was completely preventable. And it was all based upon this nonsense climate change thing.
I'd like to pull Russia in for another comment. And Michael, you were saying you were in your discussion with your friends of trying to explain why we're not in a crisis. One thing that I get asked all the time is how come you're one of the 3%? Don't 97% of all scientists agree we're in a climate crisis? And my answer to that is, well, what kind of vote did Putin get? And he gets like 80, 90% approval rating. So he didn't even get 90%. There is no known survey of that 97%. It never happened. It was a review of papers on the internet using two words as a search engine. And Barack Obama quoted it, and he has 35 million Twitter followers. And then everyone believes 90% of all scientists agree there's a climate change. You wouldn't get 30% in my profession agreement on anything, even the day of the week, you know, but 97%, why do people fall for that? You know, 97% is what the president of Turkmenistan got in his last election. How can anyone believe that 97% of all scientists agree that the IPCC is right? It's ludicrous.
That is a great point, and that's an extraordinary percentage. I hadn't even thought about that. So, Ron, we've got like 2 minutes left. I want you to tell people where they can find everything Ron Barmby, where they can buy the book, and any final comments that we need to know today.
The book is on my website, ronaldbarmby.ca. You can get it on Amazon. On that website, If you had a little bit of issue with the analogy to the fish weir, there's two presentations on there that explain. One asks the question, is climate change caused by humans or not? And the second one is climate change catastrophic or not? So you could review those. There's 24 papers that I have written since the book was published on follow-up articles, and people may find that interesting. I guess one thing I would like to end with, Michael, is one of the reasons I wrote the book is I felt that the scientific method was being politicized by our governments and it was being ignored. And it threw me back to the Age of Enlightenment and a famous quote by Immanuel Kant in 1794. He said what the Enlightenment was about is that we should all dare to know and we should all have the courage to use our own understanding. And I guess the message I'd like to leave with all your listeners is, don't let someone tell you what to think about climate change. Find out for yourself, use your own understanding, and have courage to speak up.
Ron, thank you. That message right now, I think, could be applied to a few different things that are critically important to our population of the globe right now. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Ron Barmby. He will be back because I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. He is the author of Sunlight on Climate Change, A Heretic's Guide to Global Climate Hysteria. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with our second segment in just a moment.